On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Shu Bartholomew. This is Radio Fairfax. I'm Shu Bartholomew. You're on the Commons, and joining us on the Commons today is my old buddy Bill Davis. And for my regular listeners, you've all heard Bill before, and a number of you have written to me because you love hearing him. So he's back again. He's back with good news this time because he's been through the courts and he's been having some rough times. Going to talk a little bit about it. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Shu. It's good to be back again.
It's good to have you back again, my friend. So you've had a number of years of going through the courts yourself.
Yes.
It's almost at an end. Or is it at an end?
Well, it's over for the HOA. And it's going to be,
I like the way you put that, Bill. It's over for the HOA.
Right. It's going to get ugly, pretty ugly if they want to keep trying to, we could talk about that some more, but if they keep trying to push any issues, but yes.
So you want to tell us a little bit about it? I know that it was a fairly complicated case with a lot of moving parts.
Yes, I'll try and be concise about it. Basically, we bought in a subdivision back in 2001, and when we moved in, there was the houses, they were all custom houses, so you could buy a lot that didn't necessarily have a house on it and build whenever you wanted to, but they had this weird requirement that houses had to have gas appliances, and it was also represented to us that we didn't have to drill a well, but not that we couldn't have a well. This is in a rural setting. You have to understand all the houses are on acreage and things of that nature. It was an old ranch. And at one point, we got tired of the gas appliances were all provided by propane from a central propane system. And that was neither accepted, voted on, or anything else by the homeowners, and the prices were outrageous. The vendor could dictate whatever they wanted to for the price, because propane, the cost of propane, for those folks who are on natural gas, they don't understand, because natural gas prices are economically regulated pretty much in every state. But propane is not. And we had a similar situation with water, because the developer owned the water utility. So the developer had a kickback scheme with the propane vendor and owned the water utility. Well, water utility was having lots of problems, and it's one thing to be told, hey, you don't have to drill a well. It's something else to be told. We're not going to allow you to drill one. And the crazy, so we went through and and by the way, there was never any prohibition. I didn't read the restrictive covenants to prohibit either one. But of course, there's something about people that end up on these boards and their buddies that just love to tell people, no, we're not going to let you do that. That seems, you know, it's nothing about positive, constructive, or building. It's about the power to say no to somebody else on their property.
I like the way you put that, Bill, but you're absolutely correct. I mean, that's about the only thing they enjoy doing, isn't it? Saying no.
Yeah, it's like they want to
say
be able
no,
to
say no, Bill, not yes.
Right. They want to be parents to adults and be able to tell other people no, just to, you know, make them mad. Well, we actually went through all the processes that were required, as difficult as it was to have to grovel to, you know, architectural committee members. I mean, come on, Shu. What does an architectural committee have to do with an underground structure? Because we were talking about an underground propane tank and an underground well. Okay, so what really did the architectural committee have to do with that? And what authority and what, you know, professional background of any kind do they have to say about any of these things? Well, as it turns out, the architecture committee had previously been controlled by the developer, and the developer had ceded control to the homeowners. At least that's what they represented to the homeowners. And I'll try and get to the point here, but the architectural committee had approved everything, and we weren't even required to go file documents with the county clerk's office, but these particular approvals were required to be in writing, in recordable form, and signed off by a majority of the architecture committee members. So I said, you know what, most of my, there were several other people that applied at the same time, and many of them were senior citizens. They were also people who were not necessarily familiar with how ugly HOAs could be. So I went and recorded the documents so that no one could even argue about when they were done or whether they were in recordable form. Because, again, you know, HOA board members like to dispute anything as long as they can be the king and tell you how you need to live your life. Well,
as long as they can tell you no, right?
As long as they can tell you no. So the next thing we know, this board member, who, by the way, was a partner at a prominent Texas law firm, a very large Texas law firm, who he happened to have a habit of also telling people he was a CPA, which turned out to not only be false, but when we deposed him later in the trial, he had to admit, during the litigation, he had to admit it was false, and so he ended up with a cease and desist letter against him by the Board of Public Accountancy, the Texas State Board of Public Accountancy, to never be able to go out and falsely tell people he's a CPA anymore, or he's going to be hit with a fine of up to $25,000 the next time he tried it. It's appalling that a partner at a large Texas law firm would feel some, you know, what's the problem with these people? They have some ego issue. They just can't help themselves. They have to be better or superior to everybody else. But at any rate,
by lying about something like that, being an attorney, that's amazing, Bill.
Well, it is. You know, and you'd think that the big law firm might want to have something to say about it. And this guy was also filing documents on behalf of clients with the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. And I kept thinking to myself, is this guy telling his clients that he's a CPA? Is he telling them or advising them on statements to be made in these reports that he's filed with the SEC? And I thought, this guy's not just a threat to the people that live here. He's a threat to the, you know, generally the general population out there, anybody who's investing in those companies.
And the guys didn't come with the little white jackets to get him, take him away? You know, that's what it sounds like.
Well,
you know, that's not rational.
These board members, the people attracted to those positions, I think they already suffer from some kind of serious psychological problems, because there's clearly inadequacy issues and things of this nature, and they just got to go control everybody else's life. You know, they want to make you have to change your life to recognize their presence. You know, they're in control, and you better, you know, it's just crazy. But basically, he came out and sent this email out to the whole subdivision saying that he was at the county clerk's office and he discovered these documents had been filed, and they were hereby rescinded, revoked, of no, you know. And I just thought, this guy has no authority to do any of these things. But by golly, he's telling everybody he's going to do it. And just so you know, here's some other background. The reason he was at the county clerk's office is because the developer there was a suspicion that the developer was being foreclosed upon. And he didn't even go to the right place.
Oh.
He actually went to the wrong place to check for foreclosures, because foreclosures in this county are not, they're posted, but they're not, the notices of sale are not recorded with the county clerk or anything like that. They're just put on an envelope on a folder on the countertop, and then the county, then there's also a copy posted at the front of the county courthouse. Texas is a non-judicial foreclosure state, so they sell these things by trustee. That's a whole nother that's a whole nother racket that is the subject of a lot of problems these days. At any rate, so he actually went to the wrong place to go look, and that's when he found these things, and then declares them to be invalid, revoked, rescinded. It's like, what? You know, the restrictive covenants are binding on the board too, and it actually says that the architectural committee is the one that has this authority, not the board. And a bunch of threats ensued, and because of the Texas law regarding they give the HOA attorneys an unfair advantage for legal fees, we were forced to race to the courthouse and file suit. And we filed suit, regarding the validity of the our documents as well as a couple of other items, because what the board was really doing was conspiring to hold people to an illicit monopoly on propane and water. And anyway, we, to simplify things and help cut costs, which it didn't really cut them a whole lot, we dropped the antitrust claims and just moved forward with the validity of the documents claim. I tell you what, Shu, the HOA law, they tried every crooked thing you can imagine in the book. Their attorney was extremely unscrupulous. He would, and I know this happens in lots of cases, and I just want other people to know that it's not just them. This is an industry-wide practice, and they all tend to be members of the same trade group, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
But the, you know, they'll get up there they'll cite case law that's non-existent, or they'll take quotes out of a case that don't actually exist anywhere in the case. I mean, I know in other states, attorneys get can be disbarred for these types of things, and it's appalling. I don't know if it's this particular area of law or what, but it seems to be a particularly nasty practice of fraudulent representations to a court. And they would just do this over and over. And, of course, we'd have to go to court, be more motions and more attempts to have to deal with this type of stuff. It's like a bad divorce case, I imagine. At any rate, of course, the HOA attorney, because we sued, the HOA attorney was being compensated by an insurance policy at that time, or at least the insurance carrier, I believe they had a duty to defend, and so they were paying for the HOA attorney. And so as long as he could provoke, maintain, create, you know, disputes, he was going to get paid. So that's another problem with these cases, is the inherent conflict that the HOA attorney has. He's not interested in resolving the case. He's getting paid.
And
the board members don't really, they just think they're getting a free attorney. And, of course, they're trying to facilitate their egos, because, oh, gosh, we got to show that homeowner. And by golly, if we lose this one, they'll have no respect for us. You know, not that we had any for them to beforehand, and they never seemed to figure that part out. We didn't have any respect for them to begin with. And the bottom line is they lost at trial. We had some setbacks at trial, too. We were not happy with it. We believe the court was wrong, but we weren't really going to – I don't think we were going to pursue it at that time. But the HOA attorney appeals. We were very frustrated at trial that the HOA got no award of attorney's fees against them, and even though we prevailed at trial, and we really got shafted on our attorney's fees. Well, that HOA attorney, you know, what is he really going to gain? Well, he continues to get paid, right? He continues to get paid by the insurance carrier. But why did all these people care whether we had wells or buried propane tanks, particularly if they weren't prohibited under the restrictive covenants? And you know, that's the whole no mentality. We're just not going to let you do that. And it was, there's no legitimate argument for it. It's not an aesthetic issue. And I don't think that's a legitimate argument most of the time. It's not an aesthetic issue. So why should these, and remember, we're on acreage and we're in a rural area, and all the subdivisions around us, there's no natural gas. It's all propane, and people are on well water, groundwater. So this is not something unusual, and there's even people in the city of Austin that have wells, but there seems to have been a bigger thing going on these days with local government and various other entities trying to prevent people from having access to groundwater. That's a subject of a whole other interview, I suppose. But so
yeah, but you did some digging on that as well.
Oh yes, yes.
Yes. Okay, that's another show.
Yes.
All right. Awesome.
But we go up to appeal, and the appeal, we ended up getting a clean sweep. I mean, an absolute clean sweep. The HOA, remember, they're the ones that pulled us up to the appeal. They lost on every single issue that they came up with. And, I mean, shoot, these clowns, for the first 18 months of litigation in the trial court, they claimed that it was undisputed as to, you know, there were three voting members in the architectural committee and who they were and all this other type of stuff. They changed their position only after they lost on a motion for summary judgment. And, of course, the management company keeps the records for the HOA. Do you think that they're really independent? No, of course not. They're ready to cook the books, do whatever it takes to you know, to help the HOA attorney and the board out, regardless of, you know, their obligation. So the HOA attorney realized that he's losing on the he's already lost, actually, at this point, because they admitted that there were three voting members and who they were, and we're like, yeah, we got documents signed by two of them, so we got a majority, so now what's your complaint? So then, after they lose at trial, at the motion for summary judgment at trial, they tried to claim, well, there was actually more than three. We're not sure if it was seven or maybe four or five or some other number, but it was more than three, and therefore two isn't a majority. So that's how they tried to prevail after that. And I tell you what, the expression on the appellate judge's face when he tried raising that argument again, it was just priceless. I wish there was a video of those things, because this judge, it's a female judge, and she just gave him the evil eye like you wouldn't imagine. I was enjoying this in the appellate court. I mean, it's my house is at stake on this thing. But
yeah.
I'm sitting out in the gallery, and I don't think the attorneys can always see what's going on, because we could see all the attorneys as well as the court, but the attorneys are more focused on their specific arguments, the papers in front of their face, and the individual judges they're talking to. They don't really see the whole play. I don't know how else to call it. It's like watching a play, except you have a pretty big stake in the thing. And, boy, she really, you could tell that she was not too impressed with him. At any rate.
Did she say anything, or did she just make faces?
No, she definitely said anything. In fact, she's the judge that wrote the opinion. Their argument was there was no evidence that there were three, you know, voting members. And they used one of our other complaints that the board was conducting secret board meetings and things of this nature. They actually tried using that against us and saying, well, since the board meetings were secret, you don't really know who was on the board. You don't really know who was on the architecture. I mean, this is how, you know, ridiculous their arguments were becoming. But these same people and all their witnesses, when the HOA's witnesses called each other liars on the stand, and that couldn't
have been. Oh, you're kidding.
No.
The witnesses called each other liars?
That was the HOA's witnesses, yes. Remember, we had a developer involved in this thing, too. And there's a lot of animosity between
the developer and the HOA.
Well, the developer had board members, and then there had been some homeowner board members. And there was animosity between the homeowner board members thought that this was now their kingdom. And remember, in Texas, you only got the right to vote last legislative session in these things. And so this myth about democracy, it's just so, I mean, surely that, you know, that whole concept has come and gone. I can't believe the industry is still trying to claim that these are, you know, the epitomes of democracy. But the bottom line is the appellate court decision, the HOA lost on every single issue, and the appellate court remanded it to the trial court for a determination of attorney's fees to be paid to us. So now the HOA is on the hook for attorney's fees. Not clear how much. The trial court's going to tell them how much. The HOA appeals to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, we want none of it. I mean, you know, you guys don't even have a meritorious argument here. So we finally got back. This started in 2007, and we just came back in fall of last year, 2012, from the Supreme Court, getting it back to the trial court for adjusting the determination of attorney's fees. We settled with developer number three, because we're on developer number three now, however, not the HOA. And the court rendered a decision, which is a little bit different from a judgment. They render a decision, and they then generally ask the attorneys for a proposed order, which the court will mark up or whatever and sign, and then it becomes a, you know, an official judgment and an order of the court. When the HOA attorney found out that when the judge rendered a decision holding the HOA accountable for attorney's fees, you should have seen the look on his face. He never thought that they would ever be held accountable for attorney's fees. I mean, he just thought he had free rein to run up costs on us with never having any liability. And this was malicious. It was intentional. It was just a very, very ugly, you know, very, very ugly thing for these few people on the board to do to so many homeowners in the subdivision. We were one of about 25% of the subdivision had obtained these approvals for wells and propane tanks because of serious water problems, and plus people wanted to be independent of the developer's water company, and number two, the cost on the propane, and nobody had ever agreed anywhere to buy propane from that propane system. In fact, the only obligation was to install gas appliances, not to install and use them, not to have to buy propane from their provider. So they were trying to force that by, see, if the developer maintained control of the architectural committee, then they were just going to say no and not give you a choice, and you had no way of heating your home, of cooking, or, you know, any other number of things. It was a pretty insidious thing, and I see many of these HOAs these days going this way, and it's a particular concern by design. It's a particular concern of mine for, I mean, I would normally be more of a free market person, but that's when you have a choice.
Yeah.
And this deregulation thing, it's deregulation with the, it's a no economic regulation, but also removing choice from the consumer, and that's a huge problem. But anyway, okay, back to this case.
We're playing so many games, aren't we, with words these days, Bill?
Yeah, it's. I didn't realize how many fights, and I was just trying to, you know, have a place to raise a family, and that was supposed to be kind of your sanctuary away from the work day, and it just ended up being quite a fight. But 25% of the subdivision shoe, and the board basically ran off. People either lost their houses because they couldn't sell them because of the litigation and other problems. They sold them at huge losses, but they just got out of there. And what gets me is these board members, I think they also think they're just going to live forever, and it's never going to affect them because, you know, they'll just live here after everyone else is gone. But one of the things we worked on early on was to try and pull everybody into the box that they were trying to put us into. So we put up a web page, made sure that word about the litigation was out there. We posted briefings from the court, pleadings that had been filed, as well as orders from the court, because the board couldn't be trusted to do anything except for lie. I mean, that's my personal opinion, and I suspect that happens in so many cases that people experience.
Yeah.
And it's like, look, we'll just post the pleadings out there for people to see what's been filed and what the court has actually ordered, and therefore there's no dispute anymore. And that pretty much undermined the board even further, and of course that angered them. Let's see, where are we going on that? So the bottom line is, there's been the court ordered a series of mediations, and we settled with the developer, but the HOA, there's been an amount agreed upon, and I don't think it's been paid yet, and there's still some fine details to work out on that. But we have another interesting twist, Sue. The board members thought that they were immune, right? That's how this works. They could do whatever they want. They're Superman. There's nothing you can ever do to them. They don't bear any personal financial liability for their actions. That's how they do this stuff. Well, in our case, the management company allow the HOA's charter to lapse with the franchise tax reports weren't being filed with the comptroller. And when you don't do that, and once you get warned a couple of times by the Secretary of State, they revoke your corporate privileges, meaning that the corporation...
Oh, really?
Yes. So as a technical matter, the corporation wasn't even really permitted to bring the claims that it did. They ended up counterclaiming against us, okay? And a bunch of the things we did were dealing with their counterclaims. But see, it's just not smart to raise that to their attention during the course of the trial, because if you do, then they can just fix it, okay?
Yeah.
But here's what happened. Their corporate privileges were revoked in July of 2008, and the earliest anyone can argue that they were revived is roughly March of 2010. The trial court judgment was May of 2009, so it's pretty much right smack in the middle of that time period. And when you go up on appeal and you're the prevailing party, liability relates back to the date of the original erroneous judgment. So even though our decision finally came back down in 2012, liability relates back to May of 2009, and that's why even if the court were to then order a specific dollar amount, you get that dollar amount plus interest going back to May of 2009 at a statutory rate. So all liability goes back to that time period. Well, guess what? At that time period, the HOA's corporate privileges have been revoked. And under Texas law, when your corporate privileges are revoked, the directors and officers of the corporation are personally liable for the debts and obligations of the HOA.
Oh, Normally they get a free ride, but they didn't this time.
Well, they can tell you this much. I'm not even sure that they know. They may know after this show, and I'm sure they'll be screaming. But they have tried to make life so difficult. I can't tell you how I would actually be happy if they choose not to settle, because the court's already rendered a decision, and he's indicated how he's going to rule. There's not going to be any change to that. And the appellate court already basically told him, you can't do this. You can't award these homeowners nothing. And the fees from the original trial, the jury had found in our favor for $400,000. This was in 2009. $400,000 in attorney's fees for the trial, plus costs, plus essentially $20,000 for an appeal to the appellate court and $35,000 for an appeal to the Supreme Court. Well, we dealt with appeals from both the HOA and the developer to the Court of Appeals, and both of them also appealed to the Supreme Court. So, you know, you do the math, that's 610,000, did I do the math right? 400,000 plus 110,000, that's $510,000 plus interest going back to 2009. So, I don't even think they realize it. I'm not the least bit worried about collecting it, because the HOA has assets, and so do the board members. And honestly, Shu, I would love to paint this as an example of what happens when you get egotistical board members, by the way, the management company steered them to buy this insurance policy, has also assisted them in maintaining and provoking this litigation, and also collects some of the insurance. And they're a named insured.
Wait a minute. The management company collects?
This is a whole other scam I think that people need to be aware of. The management organization, this one's organized as holding companies and subsidiaries and things of that nature, but the management company, the parent corporation of the management company is actually the owner of the insurance policy. And I don't think the board really realizes that. They probably don't know that in a lot of these HOAs. That management company, the parent is also a named insured on the policy, Shu. There's no reason for the parent of the management company
to be a
named insured on the policy for the clients of the management company. Doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
So they collect as well.
Well, I don't know what their arrangement is with the insurer on this case, but because they're the owner of the policy, the communications go between the insurance carrier and the parent company. So that's one of the problems with these management companies establishing themselves as the only interface between all these other different services, or even between the members and the HOA board. It was actually the management company that designated itself as the agent for service of process, as well as I can't remember what the other term is, and they established their address as the address for the HOA. Well, what that meant is that no board member was getting any communications from the Secretary of State about the corporate privileges being revoked. And I would just love to see the aftermath if the board and the HOA attorney continue down this path and play games about how much they're going to pay or whether they're not going to pay or whatever the homeowners. Because you know what? As far as I'm concerned, the board members are personally liable, and the law supports me on that. And I don't have any qualms about going back to court on that one.
So wait a minute. So because usually the board members are not held harmless in all of this, but in your case they're actually going to be on the hook for it.
Well, they're on the hook for it whether they realize it or not. The issue is if they want to keep provoking this, which they have done. You have to understand, every time we think we had something, an agreement, their agreements were always overreaching. You know, you need to give up all your approvals. We'll allow people to do this, but you need to give yours up. Yeah, well, if you're going to allow people to do it, then why should we give ours up? You know, every time they were just the most, they were just not people or organizations that you could deal with in good faith in any sense of the word, especially the HOA attorney. And I don't know if they realize it, but they are personally liable. And the next thing that's going to come, Shu, is if the HOA has to pay any money out on this thing, the rest of the homeowners ought to know that that was actually the personal liability of the directors and officers who now used HOA funds to pay off their debts. Right?
Oh, it's getting more and more curious and more interesting, Bill. Keep talking.
It's curious. Well, and whose fault is this? What about the management company that failed to file the reports? And
you mean the professionals that we have to have?
Oh, you know, they all claim to be members of a trade group and have different, you know, self-accreditation licenses or whatever. They're not really licenses. They're just, you know, acronyms. Oh, yeah, it's full of those types.
It's full of those types, huh?
Full of those types. The management company steers the HOA to buy insurance from an affiliate of the management company, and that relationship, of course, is not revealed to the HOA board. The naming of the parent company on the insurance policy, or the fact that the parent company actually owns a policy, or the fact that the only policies that that agency recommends are policies that are owned by its parent company, you know, those types of things aren't revealed to the board either. But the reason the management company does this, and I'm hoping to elevate this to some other agencies in the not-too-distant future, it's really a tying arrangement, because the management company comes in, they steer the board, you know, gosh, they've represented themselves to be such authorities in this area, Shu. You know, they know all about insurance and the law and everything else, and they claim fiduciary duty, like, you know, they love tossing that word around, even though no such thing exists for a nonprofit corporation in Texas. They're the ones that effectively sold them the policy. And by having a policy that's owned by the parent of the management company, it means that you cannot keep your insurance unless you retain the management company's contract. So you can't fire the management company as long as there's litigation going on. Okay? So it's really a tying arrangement, and it's one of the reasons the management companies go in and provoke these disputes, because it's guaranteed employment now. They send out those letters, charge 15, 25, 30 bucks for every letter that they send out to the HOA. That's income. They know that they're going to upset some homeowner, and eventually it's going to file a suit of some kind. That's guaranteed, you know, business for the management company as long as that litigation continues. The HOA attorney actually stood up and argued that the management company had no stake in this, which was a huge joke. And I want other people to know that these management companies have a huge stake in this, because especially the way the insurance is working out. The management companies also, at least this particular one, according to its own newsletters, they get rewarded with a cut of the premiums. They get a benefit of some type of bonus or something like that if they, I call it lure, if they con an HOA or lure an HOA into buying one of their insurance packages.
This thing sounds so corrupt, Bill.
It is corrupt. It is very complicated. It's got a lot of tentacles. But anyway, so back to the, I think I got off track. I don't even remember the original question, too. I just rehashed 6 years of litigation with these people. They're on the hook for a large amount of money, and if they can keep playing these games, but the reality is we already know we're going to prevail. I don't have the least qualms about prevailing. And if they keep playing this game, the management company's going to get exposed, his parents going to get exposed, the insurance scheme that's got is going to get exposed, and the board members are going to be personally liable. And I couldn't be guess what, the D&O policy? Same thing. So if I think the board members are going to turn around and make a claim on the D&O policy, all I can do is laugh, because the it's the same insurance scheme. And by the way, the even other attorneys in this case did not think that the insurance, that there was coverage under the policy for what's going on right now. So these board members are facing a very large personal liability if they want to keep provoking this. I mean, I'm tired of dealing with it, but I'm telling you, this might even leak back to them. I hope they have some sleepless nights hoping that this thing's going to settle at this point, because if it doesn't, but my gosh, they've had 6 years of peace and quiet and enjoying, you know, pulling wings off of insects and threatening other homeowners and you know, it's going to be coming back to haunt them. And I guarantee you there'll be people clapping in areas that we don't even know where those folks moved off to. But they essentially chased off almost 25% of the homeowners in the subdivision through threats. You know, those homeowners are no longer around. And all this is under the pretext of preserving property values.
So what have property values been doing in your subdivision?
Well, I don't think that they went up. I don't think the developer, I don't know how many lots the developer has sold, but, you know, the developer number three was essentially a hedge fund entity that now had a whole bunch of illiquid, because it's real estate property that it can't really unload. The parent entity was a hedge fund that was formed by an individual who's, you know, he's officing out in New York. He used to actually be part of, he bragged about being part of Michael Dell's personal foundation financial advisor. And he started up a hedge fund in New York and invested his clients' monies in a whole bunch of things. And there was a number of investigations, and basically he had to shut down and liquidate everything and give the investors whatever they were asking for. Well, one of the assets happens to be our subdivision. And so they've been trying to liquidate everything that they can in there. They don't really want to be a developer. In my opinion, they don't really want to be a developer, and I think that's borne out by the fact of who they are, how they got involved in this, and, you know, they would just like to sell and move on. They're really from the financial industry, not from the developer industry. But that's the long answer to your question. But because of that, it's been pretty stagnant. Even though Austin is supposedly a hot market, no, it's been pretty stagnant. And most people I know have had to take large losses on their homes.
So much for protecting property values.
Oh,
we have to have these associations, right?
They never protected property values. That's just the biggest...
The biggest lie? The biggest hoax?
Yeah, it's a pretty big... It's one of the big lies that's often told by the industry. Yeah.
You have
to have them... That they preserve property values, not for homeowners. You know, they never complete that sentence and say, for the homeowners. To me, that's the whole equivocal nature of their claims, and people buy into this and just naturally assume, oh, they mean for the homeowners. No. If they preserve property values, they preserve value in your property for the HOA managers, for the insurance companies, for the HOA banks, and all these types of things.
So... It's over, but it's not 100% over yet.
We haven't gotten the money in their bank account. Well, we don't get it. Our attorney's getting it. But the money's not in the bank account. We don't have a signed agreement from anybody. You know, they want to keep dragging it out. We'll just go back and have the court order it. I could really care less.
You know what the Ferrans did?
What's that?
They went in and got a court order to garnish all the bank accounts. And the association started whining because they couldn't do any business. They couldn't pay bills. You know, they just tied up all their bank accounts.
Yeah, the business being harassing homeowners. That's, you know, like as if that's a legitimate business to be in to begin with. We haven't done anything like that. I listened to the Ferran interview and I loved it. We haven't done anything like that, but we're pretty tired that the board has, been playing games for. I mean, the Ferrans got through it in 4 years. We've been dealing with it for 6 years, and these boogers have caused a lot of harm to people. And you know, they better straighten up their act because it's going to come back and haunt them. And I tell you what, if the management companies listen to this, I wouldn't be surprised if their organization doesn't start scrambling and trying to encourage people to settle before you know it gets really blown out about you know the management companies.
But Bill, if it settles, then you're dealing with just one, you know, if you had settled, a lot of the stuff that you guys and the Ferrans have brought out to light would never get out there, and it would be business as usual. And it's been going on for such a long time. And I applaud you, and I applaud the Ferrans, and, you know, there have been a lot of wins for homeowners lately.
There have been.
And I'm excited about that because the pendulum is starting to swing the other way.
Well, you know, I think that there's probably been wins, but it's just that the other, you know, the other things are, the industry relies so much on intimidation and falsehood and myth I think the problem is, and of course they're paid to make money from this stuff, I think there's just been a whole lot more money about propaganda claiming that the HOAs win or the HOAs always win or this type of stuff. I think the wins have been out there. It's just become more apparent or more, there's more news about homeowners winning their cases today. The you know, our case is pretty significant, and in fact the industry is not too happy about, they're the ones that took it to appeal, and they went down some tangential unrelated issue in the case, and now they've, and I'm not happy about it because my name, I'm the lead plaintiff in that case, and they've now established a precedent that isn't too happy for their industry, the idiots. That's a matter now. In fact, their argument to the Supreme Court, the reason that they thought the Supreme Court should hear the case, because like many states, the Supreme Court is a court of discretionary review, not mandatory review, and so they need to have a good reason why they need to hear the case. And so they were arguing this huge mistake of law, and how now that this has been published in the attorney's handbook. And it published that people are now going to be citing this case and relying upon it for this wrong proposition, therefore you need to do this. Shoot, it would have never even gotten to that point but for the moronic HOA attorney trying to take up an argument that had, it was all about finding ways to maintain and provoke litigation and to run up attorney's fees on us. It had nothing to do with anything meritorious in the case. And yet now that completely tangential, unrelated issue is on the books in Texas law now, and the Supreme Court's basically said, we don't want to hear an HOA attorney. So, you know, it's weird that our case will probably end up being known for that as opposed to the other issues or the other things that happen in the case. But, yeah, there have been big wins. Ours is pretty big. It's around $600,000. Plus, we prevailed on all the issues in the case. So we get our wells, we get our propane tanks and everything else, and there's nothing they can do about that. The Durham case in Houston was a big one.
Yeah, we covered that one last week.
Okay. That's like $1.3 million plus $600,000 in attorney's fees?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, almost $2 million.
Yes.
There's another one out of Texas.
Yes. And then, of course, the Ferron case.
The Ferron case, there's Manchester Oaks, there's Shadowwood.
A lot of activity there in Virginia.
There's Lake Braddock, yep.
You know, CAI might want to move their headquarters out of Virginia. Maybe they ought to get the message.
Yeah. But, you know, Bill, going back to, you mentioned that you think there have been greater wins all along. We just haven't heard about them. Quite often you end up in mediation, and there's a gag order.
Yes.
And I think that that's why we don't get it, because people contact me, and, you know, we converse, we talk, I find out what's going on, and when I follow up, it's, I'm sorry, I can't tell you, because there's a gag order, and if I tell you what happened, then I'm going to lose my firstborn. I think that's got to stop.
We weren't willing to agree to anything like that.
I know you weren't.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's why the industry wants ADR, because to keep it all private and secret so that homeowners can't tell that the HOAs are having to settle, that the HOAs are losing, and there's no record of that. And they would prefer that there not be public record of these things. It's already tough because, you know, district court opinions, and I don't know what the trial court's called in Virginia, but district courts in Texas... Pardon me?
Circuit courts.
Okay, circuit courts. The circuit court opinions and district court opinions in Texas in terms of trial-level district courts, they're not really, they're in the public record, but they're not put in the reported decisions. So, you know, lawyers have these books that are generally regional that, or even some of the Lexis and Westlaw and things like this, those organizations do not typically pick up trial court decisions if you're talking about a state trial court. It only gets published when it gets up to an appellate level decision. And I mean, it's not always true, but that's pretty much, it's almost universally the case. And so you don't really know a whole lot about the trial court cases. They're just not readily available to the typical homeowner. The practitioners know, the HOA attorneys know, because they have their own trade group and they share these cases among each other, and you know, they talk about them and put them in their little talking points when they get together, you know, annually or semi-annually at all their little golf course events or their conventions or whatever they call those things. But it's hard to know about them otherwise. Like the case in Houston, if you go out and do a search for it, yes, it's going to be in the newspaper, but it won't be a reported decision unless somebody appeals it.
Which this is the Durham case?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that is a problem, at least in some states or many states. A lot of this stuff is available online, so you can go to the local circuit or trial court or whatever you happen to call it and do a research. Unfortunately, Fairfax County does not do that, so the only way you can find out about these cases is to actually go to court.
Right.
And take a sleeping bag and plan on bunking down because you're going to be going through rooms full of records to find these things.
Right. You'll have to know the names of the parties, because at that point it's not really sorted by subject matter. Or
right.
Anything else. You can find out all the history on the particular organization you're dealing with, but you know, to go out and search for a case that stands for the proposition that you can't impose an HOA on somebody who, you know, after the fact or these general propositions, you can't really do that too effectively. You have to rely upon appellate court decisions. And the industry does not want to have bad appellate court decisions. And they've had a number of them lately.
Well, I'm willing to put all of the circuit court and trial court decisions on my website, make them available to homeowners and attorneys representing the homeowners.
Fantastic.
These are the ones that the homeowner wins.
Yes.
So if, you know, any of my listeners, if you've been through the courts, because these are public records, send them to me and we'll get them up on the website and
okay.
Make them available.
Okay.
And they'll be under headings, you know, Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, architectural control, that kind of thing. So if you're running into anything, you can find it.
Okay, that's awesome.
And it doesn't matter where, because sometimes the arguments are there, you know, the arguments work in any state.
Yes, generally precedential type opinions are more valuable if they're from the state or jurisdiction that you're in, but if there isn't anything else there, then the courts will typically turn to other states. And in fact, the North Carolina decision, the Armstrong case,
yes,
that's gotten cited now in numerous other states, Nebraska, several other states. That's the one where the board in her case is still trying to impose a mandatory association on homeowners out there, and they had to go to the North Carolina Supreme Court on that case, which finally tossed the association or the faux association out on their ear, saying you can't come in and impose an involuntary membership association on people and claim that you have the right to foreclose on their homes unless they pay you your club dues and this type of stuff. And that case has now been cited all over the country in other cases. So it can have precedential value. You would like to have one from your own state or the jurisdiction of the court that you're in, but you can still have similar arguments adopted and used by other courts. It absolutely has value, Shu.
We're running out of time, believe it or not. I don't know why these hours just fly by. But we've got a couple of minutes. And speaking of imposing an HOA where none existed, there's an insidious law in Texas that does just that, right? In Houston?
Well, there's a couple of different provisions in Texas that would allow that. You know, an HOA there's a lot of the pro HOA people that don't seem to understand that you can have restrictive covenants without having an HOA, but the way that an involuntary membership HOA is usually imposed is through a specific restrictive covenant imposing such a thing. And so any state law that allows for an amendment of restrictive covenants can potentially allow for the imposition of an involuntary membership HOA on people who didn't want it. In Houston, in particular, there's a statute called Texas Property Code Chapter 204 that is geographically bracketed to Houston, And it creates a very unlevel playing field for homeowners who want absolutely nothing to do with an HOA. In fact, the City of Houston, SHU, their planning department, they've got some flow charts showing what happens if you try to do this through one property code provision through versus another. Under one property code provision, it actually respects your constitutional rights and property rights and everything else and says you don't have to be a member if you don't want to. You don't have to agree to this. So the City of Houston warns, they're willing to provide pro bono attorneys to come out and convert your neighborhood into an involuntary membership association, and they want everybody to use Texas Property Code Chapter 204, which purports to authorize involuntary membership associations that you cannot opt out of. And, claiming that people choose these things is another huge industry issue. And, I mean, you and I both know that. I mean, these things are being mandated by local government policies, federal government policies, but it's particularly insidious when you bought property free and clear, and a city or some other mysterious organization can come in and suddenly claim that you're an involuntary member of their little group and that you have to pay assessments and dues and things of this nature and tolerate a tyrant controlling you and your property, or else they're going to take your property. I mean, that's already a taking. And the fact that you've got local government pushing private corporations or involuntary membership in these things, that's a really ugly private, public partnership. And they like to say, well, you don't have any constitutional rights because it's a corporation, not a government, and yet it's your government that's imposing these on people. Yes, but that's Texas Property Code 204. It's pretty bad. And it'll get challenged in time. It hasn't been yet, but it'll get challenged.
I hope so. The other thing that's really nasty, and this is in states that have the UKIOA, the Uniform Common Interest Laws. What they're doing now is they're getting judicial amendments to the governing documents. So if the board decides that they need some powers that the governing documents do not give them, and they propose an amendment and do not get the amendment because the homeowners don't want anything to do with it, they can now go to a court and say, look, we feel that these people need this, and they're just too apathetic to sign the documents, so we want you to go ahead and make the changes. So the contract that's outrageous.
That's pretty bad. One of the things that I've noticed the industry pushing in many states, and especially here, we don't have. To me, calling it, would you call it UKIOA?
UKIOA, yeah.
Okay, to me, it ought to be UKLOA because it's not. There's no common interest. It's nothing but a common liability. But what the industry's been pushing here, and if you really think about it, this is like the worst class of debt collectors ever created by man. They're in the business of creating debt out of nothing, and then using that to pyramid up fees through late fees and fines and things of this nature, mainly to benefit the HOA attorneys and the management company.
Right.
But one of the things that they're pushing here is, I know they're doing this in other states, is trying to give the boards, the industry needs the board to have as much power as possible without any input or review by any homeowners. And they've been pushing to allow boards to borrow money without a vote of the members, regardless of what any restrictive covenants or bylaw provisions provide. Now, they did that, either last session or two sessions ago in Texas with respect to condominiums. So their push right now, SHU, and this is really, they would have gotten noticed if they tried doing this two sessions ago, but what the industry is really trying to do is latch on to and strip it away from the property, meaning the subdivision or condominium or whatever it happens to be. They're trying to strip off the infinite accounts receivable from the HOA. So now what they want is for the quote, right to collect or right to receive payments to be collateral for loans that the board takes out without any approval by the members. So now you just went from not being able to take out loans to being able to take out loans without the permission of the members. And by the way, their homes are what's security,
yeah,
what the collateral is for that,
yeah,
for that loan. You don't have to get their permission, and now the HOA or condominium's right to receive the payments is going to be the collateral. We've already seen some where the so-called banks, oftentimes these aren't real banks, these are banks with a BANC, they're not actual depository institutions, their industry banks are actually seeking an outright assignment of the right to collect. What they're effectively trying to do is purchase an instant accounts receivable for a pittance. And, of course, the board members think they just got this great deal. Hey, we just got $1 million.
Yeah,
you just gave them an infinite income stream
for
$1 million, and they don't have to use that money in the place. And if you don't pay it, they can foreclose upon you. They don't have any obligation to provide services to you of any kind. And I think that this is really almost at the criminal stage, because the management companies come in, they con gullible board members, people who just don't even understand what they're doing. And, you know, they claim to be advisors and, you know, oh, we're experts and this will just, you know, it'll improve your community. And it's not hard to find board members who want to create a monument to themselves. I mean, this is what happened in Robin Clark's neighborhood. You interviewed Robin Clark a few
years ago.
It was a few years ago? It seems like months at this point. But, you know, they wanted to build a monument to themselves in the form of a giant new recreational center that, I mean, gosh, it was Houston, Texas. You can go down the street to join a gym if you want to, and you can also quit, and you don't have to have those monthly payments anymore. But what they were going to do is tie everybody's home into having to pay for this, you know, this gym into perpetuity. And so it's an additional liability, and the HOA was giving away that what the bank was seeking was an outright assignment of the right to collect assessments from the homeowners or for the HOA to the bank or to the financial entity.
Welcome to a brave new world called America with a K. Bill, we're out of time.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sue.
You know, I always love it when you come on, and I always love it when you...
Good news?
Well, good news is good news.
Yes.
But thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Sue.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.